Accession number 32297, reel 13.
John Dixon, reel 13. You joined the squadron at Streatham?
That's right, yes, yeah. June the 1st, 1944. When I got there, I was joined by, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 other pilots, young, similar sort of background to me, and we discovered that we were going to be flying fairy barracudas, which at that time, well, I mean, we knew they weren't the best aeroplanes in the world, but you... What could you say? I mean, that was what you were going to be equipped with, and you just had to make the best of it. They were never very popular aeroplanes. Operationally, they had severe limitations, but all this, of course, wasn't apparent to us at the time.
How had you heard of its reputation? Was it something that you would talk amongst yourselves, or people would have had experience of it prior to you actually operating in one?
Yes, I think it was just general knowledge in the fleet here. The whole, in case anybody doesn't know, that the Fairy Barracuda was meant to replace the Fairy Swordfish. It was a three-seater aircraft, pilot, observer and air gunner, the same as a Swordfish. But of course it had got enclosed cockpits. It was a monoplane. It was a shoulder wing monoplane. It was meant to carry torpedoes and do dive bombing and carry mines and depth charges and all that sort of thing. It could do all that, but the basic problem with it, and of course this wasn't apparent to us at the time, it was underpowered. It had a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, but it needed something bigger. I think at one time they had thought they were going to put a Rolls-Royce Vulture engine in it, but that engine proved a disaster because they tried it in the RAF in the Manchester bombers, and that was no good. So we didn't get any Vultures, and then the other engine that it really needed was a Rolls-Royce Griffin, which it got. But not until the war was over. The Griffins, of course, were being used for the Fireflies. But had we had a more powerful engine, that would have helped. But it wouldn't have helped the fact that it lacked range, which may not have been too important operating around Britain and off Norway and that sort of area. But when we got out to the Pacific, but I'm jumping ahead of myself now, of course the lack of range was going to be vital. But there we are, their lordships of the Admiralty had ordered these things from ferries, and in fact there were more Barracudas built than any other naval aeroplane, slightly more than the Swordfish. As I say, it wasn't a very popular aeroplane, and there were several unexplained accidents, which I might refer to a bit later on. It wasn't good news. The other thing was that there were six of us who joined the squadron who had trained in America, believe it or not. And they were a very select few who had been flying the Douglas Dauntless dive bombers, which the Americans had found highly effective in the Battle of Midway. They weren't terribly modern aeroplanes, but they looked good. And of course, being trained in America, these lads thought they were the bee's knees, and they thought when they arrived at Streatham to find the Barracudas waiting for them, they felt that they'd been desperately let down. But having, again, I'm rather running ahead of myself, having clocked on June 1st at 812 Squadron, As I say, there were quite a few of us had never ever flown a Barracuda before, so we had to go and learn. And just across the other side of the airfield, there was a squadron called 798 Squadron, which was just basically to convert people onto Barracudas. So I went there with the others just for a matter of days, and the first thing they flew me in was a Mars Master with an instructor in the back. I can't think what that was about because we'd done all that, but I suppose he was just making sure that I was competent. And from there they put me on to a Fairey Fulmar, which of course had been the main fleet fighter in 1940, and had done exceptionally well when we were just fighting the Italians in the Mediterranean. It was an 8-gun fighter. For anybody that doesn't know, it looked, I suppose, like an overgrown Hawker Hurricane. But of course, being Navy, they'd put two seats in it, and it had an observer, or it could have done. But it had done extremely well. It could shoot down the Italians, and it did. It did behave perfectly well out there. But when the Germans arrived in the Mediterranean with Messerschmitts and goodness knows what, the poor old Fulmar was hopeless and had to be withdrawn, and it was just being used for training purposes. The main thing, I suppose, Richard, was having got into the Fulmar, it was the first time I'd ever flown behind a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, and we all know that they'd got a wonderful reputation. It's a pity they put it in the Barracuda, but still, that was the first time I flew behind a Merlin engine.
How did the Fulmar handle?
Quite straightforward, really. It was, the ones we had were very old, so you didn't really want to try too much, but in any case, we weren't going to be fighter pilots, so I think I did 5 or 6 trips, and from my memory is that it was more getting used to flying in that sort of environment from Stretton, where it could be murky and misty, and finding your way round and to an airfield which wasn't on the coast.
When you're converting to a new aircraft, are you given a set of pilot notes for that aircraft as well?
Oh yes, you're given a set of pilot notes which you're supposed to learn word for word. I don't think anybody ever could learn the whole lot, but basically what you needed to know was the speeds at which it would stall and the speeds at which you should approach and the power settings for this, that and the other, where you should set the trimming controls to trim the aircraft for takeoff and that sort of thing. Generally things that you should and shouldn't do with it. I mean, there are limitations, of course, on any aeroplane. So don't exceed this speed, don't do this and don't do that. But you learnt these things, and you were sort of tested on them by an instructor before you went off. But common sense, really, I suppose.
Once you'd done your 5 or 6 trips in the Fulmar, was that when you were introduced to the Barracuda, or was there another step in the process?
No, straight then to the Barracuda. And again, you just had an instructor to show you the cockpit, and you had your pilot's notes. But always there was an instructor just to show you the various controls, and how to start it and how to stop it and silly little things like that. But of course there was no dual control Barracudas or Fulmars for that matter, so once you'd been shown you were on your own. And of course the first trip in a strange aeroplane, Easter Isle, was went very, very carefully and gingerly and checked everything 3 or 4 times before I did anything. But having got the thing into the air, of course, once you're in the air, everything, you know, the controls all work the same for any aeroplane.
Am I right in thinking it stood quite a high up in on its wheels?
Yes, it was if I'm not upsetting anyone, it was a bastard-looking aeroplane to look at. It really was an ugly-looking beast, because the shoulder wing arrangement was purely there so that the observers who sat in the middle had underneath the wing, they needed to be able to see out. They were observers, and that was that what their lordships of the Admiralty wanted them to do, to spot fleets and gunfire and all this sort of thing. It was all a bit archaic, really, but this is what they were there to do, to see. And on the sides of the Barracuda, there were like little bow windows, like blister windows, so that they could sort of more or less lean out. And wonderful cartoons of them. You can see cartoons of Barracudas where the observers' little windows, instead of just having a compass set on a ledge inside the window, which is where what they did have, there were pictures of chintz curtains and table lamps, and it was. But from an observer's point of view, it was a wonderful aeroplane. I mean, they've never had such comfort. And they could either sit sort of on the floor, as it were, and look through these windows, or they could sit slightly higher up, or they could even stand up if they could see out of the top of the cockpit. But it was built as an observer's aeroplane. In the back, there was an air gunner with his radio, telegraphist air gunner. He was a bit sort of superfluous, I would think, and most of them felt this way. They had a pair of Vickers machine guns, which were housed underneath the sort of cockpit, the fuselage cowling, as you were, facing backwards, these guns. And when the telegraphist air gunner wanted to fire them, he raised a hood, his own hood, which was on like a hydraulic pressure, I think it was hydraulic or compressed air, and he had to force this hood open against the airflow, and it locked sort of solid once it was open, and then he drew these guns backwards towards him. He's facing the tail, so he drew these guns backwards from underneath this fuselage, and then somehow erected them so that they pointed upwards and outwards. But they were only 303 machine guns, and I don't think they could have shot anything down. I don't think there's any record of a telegraphist air gunner in a Barracuda ever shooting anything down. I may be wrong on that one, but they were pretty useless in a way, but we had to have them, and I suppose comforting to think that
What about for you as the pilot, visibility, what was that like in the Barracuda?
That was fine, you sat up quite high, you sat just above the shoulder wing at the front, so you were restricted in looking sort of slightly behind you and down. You couldn't actually see the undercarriage. I think we've rather digressed a little bit, because you asked about this undercarriage. Well, because of the wing being so high, and because there was no way that the undercarriage could actually fold into the fuselage, it had to fold up and into to the wing. So if you can imagine, the undercarriage was like a big letter L on its side, with looked like steel girders, looked like the fourth bridge to me, that came out, and a tremendous amount of hydraulic pressure required to lift these undercarriage wheels, and the whole thing then folded back. The sides went into little channels in the fuselage, but the main wheels went up into the wing, and when you took off and you selected undercarriage up, I mean, the pressure on the hydraulic system must have been enormous, and there were one or two nasty incidents. But as the wheels came up, the pressure was such that one wheel would come up a little bit, and then the other one would come up a little bit, and they didn't come up nice and evenly, so that...
Because the pause is a bit funny sometimes.
Yes, yeah, so there it is. As I say, the undercarriage came up in a very uneven manner, which made controlling the aircraft as you were taking off a little bit difficult. And you could always tell a sort of rookie pilot, because the plane sort of zigzagged as it took into the air as these wheels came up. But apart from that, it was a very heavy aeroplane, or heavy-ish, put it that way, so that when you were landing it, which was very good for deck landing, once you took the power off, it plonked down very, very solidly, provided you got it in the right attitude, and it didn't bounce around or anything like that. Once it was on the ground, it was on the ground. So it was quite a good deck landing aeroplane, I'll give it that.
Was there any capacity for the pilot to fire forward at all?
No, we had no guns. No, the only guns were the telegraphist air gunner in the back. There were no forward firing guns. No, the pilot's weapons were what we had to drop.
So you would have to rely on the air gunner for the protection of the aircraft?
Yes. Excuse me laughing. No, I think had we ever been in a combat situation with fighters chasing us, we'd have had to rely on our own fighters to chase them off. I don't think we could have got very far.
You did these first few flights. You said that you were quite cautious in handling a new aircraft. How many kind of familiarisation flights would you do, or would you do a series of circuit and bumps till you were feeling happy about handling it?
Well, I looked in my logbook and I did 5 trips in the Barracuda while I was in 798 Squadron. And these were done in a matter of 3 or 4 days. So, you know, once you'd got comfortable with flying the aeroplane and knew its limitations, well, that was it. And at that stage, back across the airfield to 812 Squadron, which is where I was meant to be.
I take it with something like that in those familiarisation flights, you wouldn't, or couldn't do anything like aerobatics, so it would be a fairly set standard of manoeuvres, would you?
Yes, I don't know. I presume we must have been told to stall the aircraft, but certainly you didn't spin it, you didn't spin a Barracuda. We weren't supposed to, you weren't supposed to do any aerobatics, but I could just mention later on, when we got really confident and knew what we were doing, and I must have been 3 or 4 months down the line, when, you know, we really thought we got it mastered, and we had. I managed to loop one. I did a loop when I was flying solo and found it quite easy to loop the aircraft, and some of the other lads looked at me and said, well, you can't do that, and I said, well, I've just done it. and my crew, by then I'd got a crew, which we might come to later, I took them up and looped the aeroplane with them in it, and they thought this was all quite good, and it gave them a bit of confidence in their pilot, I suppose. But we had one pilot called Throssell, who was one of the American trained lads, and he really was he was called Ace, because he thought he was, and he was a jolly good pilot. He actually rolled a Barracuda, and I didn't think that was possible, but he could do that, and he could roll a Barracuda. I never tried it. I thought I was too frightened.
So you went back to the squadron.
Mm.
What's the kind of progress that you make there? What's the kind of things?
Well,
that you
we were there for the whole of June. We stayed at Stretton during June, and if you can remember what happened on June 6th of 1944, we were all terribly excited about D-Day and what was happening, but we were stuck there in the north of England, or wherever it is, Midlands, north of England, and felt rather out of it, but at least we were operating as a squadron. And I don't know whether this is a good point to bring this in, Richard, but normally, the normal training is, having finished at Errol and got used to British aircraft again, if you were going to be a torpedo bomber reconnaissance pilot, which we were, you would then normally, as an individual, go to Crail, which is on the Firth of Forth, where you did a torpedo course, and that would last 2 months, and they taught you how to do use torpedo work, how to drop them by day, by night. You would do a certain amount of dive bombing, and then from there, having qualified from Crail, you would go further up the east coast of Scotland to East Haven, where you would do a deck landing course, where you would practice on the airfield until you were confident in, or competent, to take your aeroplane to the deck. And that would all be done as individuals. And when you, as a pilot, had done all these things, you were then sent to a pool. When I say a pool, it means a pool of aircrew. And I'm not sure, but I think this was at an airfield called Inskip, which was on the northwest coast somewhere. And there you met up with observers and air gunners who'd been trained individually in their own schools, and they would come together, and that's where you would form your crew. I don't know, we never went through this process, but so I don't know actually how you formed a crew. But that's where you were. And then, having formed a crew and just kept your hand in as a crew, when you were needed to join a squadron as a crew, then you went as a squadron, as a crew, to fill in any gaps in the squadrons that already existed. That's the normal way of training. And we in 812 squadrons broke the mould, partly because our CO was a chap called Cedric Coxon, who was an absolutely brilliant pilot, and had a wonderful, had a very productive war in Malta flying Swordfish, and I think he was 23 years old when we formed 812. And I'm told he was the youngest lieutenant commander in the Navy. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But we all worshipped him. He was over 6 foot tall, very good looking chap, and everybody's idea of what a naval officer should look like. He was RNA, in other words, he joined on a short service commission just before the war. So he wasn't just your normal wavy Navy like we were. But we, as a squadron, 812, we did all our training as a squadron. So we became friends as soon as we joined up. We got to know one another. Cedric and the senior pilot and the senior observer, they all got to know us. If, as we progressed through our training period, or working up period, as we like to be told, as it was known, if Cedric had been unhappy about any individual pilot, he got rid of them. And we did lose two or three pilots who just sort of disappeared because they weren't up to his standard. And so those of us that carried on, our egos got bigger and bigger and bigger, and we were the first squadron to train like this. two other squadrons came after us at 1 month intervals. We started 1st of June, they started July and August. They were 814 and 837 squadrons. And we all ended up on the light fleet carriers, but I'm getting ahead of myself again. But we were the first.
And was the idea behind this that it gelled people together, really, rather than the older process where everybody kind of joins rather later on? Once you've done your training, you join the Observer and the Air Gun. Are you actually gelling together as a team much earlier on and as a squadron much earlier on?
Well, that's exactly what happened, Richard. That was it. Whether that was the motive, I don't know. But it certainly worked as far as we were concerned.
So were you introduced to your Observer and Air Gunner early on at all?
No, not initially, no. I mean, the first 3 months, it was mainly pilot exercises we were doing. I mean, the Observers weren't concerned about how to drop torpedoes, and the Air Gunners weren't involved in that. So we didn't actually gel up with them too soon. Having said that, we did, when we formed the squadron, we were basically all pilots. There were four senior observers there, and they were when I say senior, they'd seen plenty of service. Four of them, and there were about six air gunners who, again, had seen quite a bit of service. We didn't get the full complement at that stage, but I didn't have an observer at that period, but there was an air gunner called Jeff Squire who rather took to me, and I suppose I like the look of him, I don't know, but we tended to fly together sort of unofficially, as it were. We didn't officially become a crew till later on.
So you would still fly with an observer and an air gunner at that period, or would you not? Would it be mainly yourself?
Mainly myself. There's no reason why you shouldn't have taken up an observer or an air gunner. I did occasionally take Jeff Squire up and one or two other air gunners, but we didn't need observers at that period.
So this period of the first period when you go to the squadron, this is purely to hone your piloting skills really with the aircraft, is it?
Yes.
And to see that, obviously, that the squadron commander's looking at how you're...
That's right.
...getting along with that aircraft.
And to begin to learn how you would fly the aircraft in an operational condition. And I now tell the famous story as to Dixon and his escapade... which sounds absolutely ridiculous. People will think I'm the biggest idiot ever.